Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, January 13th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, thanking the nurses, technicians, and the entire staff at Saratoga Hospital for the care they provide. Saratoga Hospital, people you trust, care you deserve. SaratogaHospital.org. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Vincent Carcillo of Capital District Renal Physicians. He is here to discuss internal medicine and nephrology. He has an extensive background in these areas and is board certified in both. Promises to be a fascinating program, therefore a busy program. So be sure to get your calls in early. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us as well. voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Vincent Carcillo and your calls coming up on Medical Monday after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Dr. Vincent Carcillo of Capital District Renal Physicians is here to discuss internal medicine and nephrology today. He is board certified in both areas. Dr. Carcillo has been with CDRP since 2004 and is the current president and managing partner of the practice. A graduate of the University of Scranton, he completed medical school at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. He trained in nephrology at Albert Einstein Medical Center in Philadelphia. His clinical focus is on home dialysis. If you have a question today, call now, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, and you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Vincent Carcillo, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I love the show, and I'm so happy to be back.
What is it about home dialysis that struck you, that made it your focus?
There are so many things, honestly. And when I first came to the area, one of the things that drew me to this practice was that they were very open to allowing me to grow a home dialysis program. And so patients, as you may know, who need dialysis in most parts of the country, go to a dialysis center 3 times a week. For about 4 hours for each treatment, which is a lot of time, a lot of your life spent traveling to and from a treatment that takes 4 hours.
Yeah.
So the ability to be able to do that same type of treatment, to get the same type of cleaning of the blood, which is what dialysis does, at home, in the privacy of your own home, potentially in your own chair while you're watching TV or in your own bed while you're sleeping at night, just such a better lifestyle alternative.
I mean, what are some of the possible drawbacks of somebody doing it at home?
Sure. Well, there is one potential drawback, which is the patient has more work to do. So they may need to set up a machine, which may take 15 to 20 minutes before they go to bed at night. They may need to learn how to do things with their hands, with bags of fluids, that kind of thing. So there is some work. But I actually think that although you may look at that as a drawback, I think it's also a benefit. I think when patients are more engaged in their care, they tend to do better.
Okay, but I assume, and I don't know what this equipment is, but I assume A, the equipment needs regular cleaning and maintaining, and B, humans being what they are, some can get a little lazy. How do you know that people keep up on their dialysis when they're doing it themselves?
Yeah, and it's such a good perspective and such a good question. And I think that there are a couple of pieces to that. We are able to keep in touch with patients, and the nurses are in touch with those patients almost on a daily basis. So we know when the patients are doing and not doing their treatments, and a lot of that information is sent electronically to us. So we can monitor the patients that way, but I think part of what you were kind of getting at is a point that a lot of nephrologists actually struggle with, which is who's a good candidate for home dialysis. You know, in the past, at least in the past several decades, very few people have been given that choice, given the opportunity for some reason. Too old, too heavy, you know, too not so smart, that kind of thing.
Right.
But you would be surprised. I have trained patients to do dialysis at home who were brilliant, who were on the other end of the spectrum, who were very obese, very skinny, very old, very young, that you'd be surprised at how many patients are good candidates to dialyze at home if you give them the opportunity.
And you find that most of them will stay up on this? See, my concern would be, oh, I missed it this time. I'll get it the next time. And then, spiraling out of control, you got a dead patient on your hands.
Yeah, yeah. And so every once in a while, we do have that issue. But that can also happen with in-center treatments. We have patients that sometimes don't show up for a treatment, and that can become a bad habit. So it's up to the clinician and the team that's at the dialysis unit, which includes a social worker, a dietitian, nurses. Everyone's kind of engaged with the patient to make sure that they're aware of how important it is to keep up with this.
Dr. Vincent Carcillo is our guest on Medical Monday. He is here to discuss internal medicine and nephrology. The number is 800-348-2551. And, Doc, before we get to the calls, this email came in from Mike in Richmond. Given the popularity of high-protein diets like paleo and keto, could you discuss any possible implications these diets may have on the development or worsening of kidney disease? And that's from Mike in Richmond.
Well, thanks for that question, Mike. This question does come up pretty frequently, and I actually get calls from a lot of primary care doctors who are interested in this from time to time during the day about patients who need to lose weight. And I think the answer to that question is a little bit complicated. There was a study going back 10, 15 years ago that did show that people who had kidney disease, which was mostly related to diabetes in that study, they did worse when they had more protein in their diet. Mm. They had more protein in their urine, and kidney function tended to get worse more quickly than their counterparts that had low protein. So that being said, in many instances, we have patients who are very obese, and their obesity has sparked them to have diabetes, which is causing their kidneys to decline. And in those cases, weight loss is so essential. Sometimes that may be the only way to help. And if that's the case, there's that, you know, risk-benefit ratio that you have to weigh in.
Our number here is 800-348-2551, and let's take a call or two before our first break. Donna in Woodstock. Donna, you're on.
Hi. I actually thought of another question on the way.
Amazing.
of course, everyone does, right? How do you manage the potassium and magnesium thing? Say, I've watched people have kidney failure and heart failure, and, you know, you always had to do that. But, all right, that's the first question, or the second question. But the first question is swollen feet and ankles, which I have now, but I've had periodically over the years on and off, and I'm a photographer, so I have pictures of this, only now there's spots. I have spots and it's itching. So is that related? And should I run to the hospital? I don't want to do a Jim Henson.
Nice.
Okay, Donna. So there are a couple questions there. The first one about managing potassium and magnesium. Those electrolytes can sometimes be affected by chronic kidney disease, and certainly in people who have end-stage kidney disease. In most cases, in people who have mild to moderate disease, they don't need to do much with their diet in terms of potassium. But as kidney disease gets worse over time, kidneys start to sometimes excrete less potassium. It can build up in your system, and then it does become something that we restrict the diet for. And in some patients—
Is that apple juice or orange juice that you can't have?
Well, orange juice of those two would have a lot more potassium in it. And so we restrict that. Sometimes we even institute a medication to help patients keep those potassium levels down. So with
I witnessed this, you know, my father signed himself out of the hospital. He was getting dialysis, and he was screaming, oh, you could give me $25 million tax-free, and I won't do another treatment. So he called hospice, and, you know, very sad.
That is a sad case. And, you know, dialysis is a difficult treatment for some people, especially if you have, you know, many, many medical problems going into it. So
is
a
it
lot
painful?
Of different people dialyzing. It's not painful.
Yeah, well, this would have been good. I mean, this was 15 years ago. I'm thinking, wow, if they would have had it then.
Mm. Now, you had another question, really, Donna, right?
Oh, yes. The question is
your
today.
Feet.
Oh, yeah.
My feet.
Your feet. Yes. So, Donna, your feet are swollen. And so you said you're a photographer. You're probably on your feet quite a bit. And you probably have been for a long time if that's been your career. Now, some people do get swollen feet because of kidney disease, but there are actually a lot of reasons that your feet can swell, and different organ systems that can be affected. Sometimes persons who have heart disease, sometimes persons who have liver disease. There are a lot of different things that can cause swelling. For sure, if you haven't been seen by your primary care doc about this, it's something that you want to get in to be seen. Sometimes it's as simple as a simple urine test that can help to steer you in the right direction.
All right, Donna, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Vincent Carcillo is our guest. It's Medical Monday, internal medicine and nephrology today. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Vox Pop Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Vincent Carcillo is our guest. Two emails here, doctor, and then back to the phones we shall go.
Okay.
This one is from Grateful in the North Country. How can a kidney cyst be determined to be benign? I have multiple cysts, one about a centimeter. I can't have contrast in MRIs, so I'm curious as to the degree of certainty one can gather from a less than optimum test. Do you think a needle biopsy is indicated? And that is from Grateful in North Country.
Okay, well, that's a great question. And we see a lot of cysts every day in the practice. And sometimes those cysts are found by accident even. When a person has a cyst in the kidney, most cysts are what they call simple cysts. And a simple cyst, imagine if you were kind of looking at it head on, it would look like you were looking at a bubble. It just looks like a simple circle with thin walls. Those cysts are usually benign. If that looks like anything other than a simple bubble head on, thick walls, septated.
What's septated?
Means there's kind of something kind of separating that cyst in the middle.
Gotcha.
Or a part of the cyst is firm or solid. Anything that's outside that box is a little bit more worrisome. And depending on the cyst, there may or may not be anything that a urologist would do, but that is the person that you would go to if there was a cyst that was concerning. But again, most people who have simple cysts, generally those are benign.
All right. This is from Jay. I take allopurinol for gout. Is gout or allopurinol stressful to the kidneys over time? Are there any new, better choices for medication? Can diet help?
So allopurinol has been the standard of care for gout treatment for many, many years, and it's still very, very common in use right now in medicine. There are some newer agents available, and there are some other agents available, one called colchicine, that you do have to be careful with kidney disease, but it's usually not that those medicines hurt the kidneys. It's that they need to be dose adjusted because kidney function is not normal.
Gout. I knew somebody who had it once, but it affected the legs. But what is it exactly?
It's a buildup of a kind of acid called uric acid, which your body has in it normally. But in the case of gout, that acid is accumulating in joint spaces.
And why does that happen?
It's a kind of a form of inflammation.
Yeah.
And so that causes those joints to become irritated and swollen. And can be treated with medication.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Vincent Carcillo is here from Capital District Renal Physicians. And we go now to Jenny in Catskill. Jenny. Jenny's gone. Well, goodbye, Jenny. That was fun. Let's go to Jim in Adams, Massachusetts. Hello, Jim.
Hey, Ray.
How you doing?
Yes, doctor. My maternal grandmother died of, I was told, Bright's disease. She was very nauseous. My mom remembers taking care of her, and you couldn't cook any food in the house when she was sick like that, and you couldn't eat anything hardly. She would go in the pantry and just eat some dry oatmeal and raisins to keep herself something in her stomach while she was tending to her mom. But is Bright's disease anything related to or similar to another condition they call yellow jaundice?
So thanks for that, Jim. yellow jaundice is a separate thing. So jaundice is generally caused by liver disease, which is a buildup of something in your blood that has a yellow pigment in it.
Mm-hmm.
Bright's disease, I'm not calling you out on your age, Jim, and I don't know how old you are, but Bright's disease.
I'm 76 tomorrow.
Hey, happy birthday, Jim.
Happy birthday, Jim. So it's a Bright's disease is a term that we actually, it's a historical term. We don't use that term anymore. It was kind of a generalized term to talk about inflammation in a part of the kidney called the glomerulus, and we call that glomerular nephritis. We have a lot more specific classifications for that now. Say again?
Bright's disease was a condition was named after a person who discovered it or something, perhaps?
Yes, that's right. That's right. And we have much more specific classifications now.
As far as the swelling of the feet, I get that if I fall asleep in my chair at night and stay there long, but every night I usually have a pillow underneath the foot of the bed, underneath the blankets and sheets, and that helps a lot, get your circulation back out of the lower extremities.
Well, there's a reason, right, that swelling usually starts in the feet, and that's gravity. So when you elevate those
gravity,
legs, it's helpful.
It's an occupational hazard for barbers even, on their feet a long time.
Sure is.
Hey, Jim, happy birthday. How big of a cake do you have to get 76 candles on there, man?
Half the size of a football field.
You better get baking. Hey, Jim, thanks a lot for the call, man.
All right.
Have a good one. Let's go to another Jim. Jim and Matamoros, you're on.
What part of the kidney is most affected by diabetes?
By diabetes. Thanks, Jim. So diabetes is affecting more than just the kidneys, right? And so you'll see people who have diabetes have a lot of different potential problems. Problems with their eyes, problems with their heart, problems with the larger blood vessels that supply blood to the legs, and problems with the kidney. The first place that diabetes starts to affect these body parts is the tiny little blood vessels in the body. And those tiny little blood vessels in the kidney are wrapped around individual little filtering units called a glomerulus. And that glomerulus is kind of like a pasta strainer. Some things get through, some things don't, mostly salt and water. And as diabetes damages those little blood vessels, those little filters get affected. And that's why you'll hear in many cases with people who have diabetes, they'll start to see protein in their urine. It's a form of damage.
Yeah. All right. All right. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551, the number. It's Medical Monday today. Dr. Vincent Carcillo is our guest. And Franny in Copaic. Franny.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am 73. This is more of a urology question, but I just wanted an opinion. I have a most likely malignant small mass on my kidneys. Otherwise, I'm very healthy. It's growing slowly. 1 year, the urologist told me to leave it alone because I was so old that it would grow too slowly. And then the next year, they said, well, maybe I should have it removed. So I'm just curious what you think about a renal mass and an otherwise healthy 73-year-old, whether to have it removed or not.
Yeah, so it's, Franny, it's hard to say or at least speak to an individual case without knowing you and reviewing your medical records and that kind of thing. But renal masses can sometimes be very small, sometimes be very big. In many cases, they are slow growing, and we've seen urologists watch some of those masses. There are a lot more options now than there used to be even 10 years ago when the whole kidney would need to be removed. Now, sometimes they can freeze out some masses or just remove a part of the kidney where the mass is. So if you're uncomfortable with that with that one urologist's opinion, if it's kind of wavered over time, it may be worth your while to seek out a second opinion.
That's what I'm doing right now. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
No, you're very welcome.
Now, there are two kidneys, right? And
yes.
Some people can get by on one, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Why in the evolution of human beings did we get two when you can get by on one?
Yeah, it's so fascinating, isn't it, the human body? And there is redundancy built into the system. In fact, some people actually are not. Some people are just born with one kidney.
Anybody ever born with three?
Yes.
Really?
And more. Yeah, it's
what's the max?
Max I've seen.
Yeah.
was 4.
Okay, well, that's a lot.
It is. It is, and that so that comes from as kind of fetuses are developing. Sometimes if there are problems during that process, you can see aberrancies like that. But generally, we're born with 2. In some people, they're born with 1, and they live their whole life just fine with that 1 kidney. It does generally grow to be about the size and weight of 2 kidneys, interestingly enough.
Fascinating. Our guest today is Dr. Vincent Carcillo. We talk internal medicine at nephrology. 800-348-2551 is the number. And Ann in Grafton is next. Ann.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a home health care aide, and I'm working with a man who's in basically final stages of kidney failure. And we just got a fistula put in his arm so that he could do dialysis. But he really wants to do dialysis at home, so that kind of sounds like what you work with. But I want to know what are the restrictions on you? What do you have to do to have it at home? Do you have to keep the house extra clean? Do you have to do anything extra?
Well, it's a great question, Ann. Thank you. And the first step is to have a home, right? One of the few contraindications to home dialysis is being homeless.
Yeah.
In some instances, you do need to have more space than a person might have in a small apartment or something like that for supplies. So, but most standard size homes are just fine for dialysis. And unless you have multiple pets in a very kind of dirty environment, most environments are just fine for that too. Now, it's interesting that your patient has a fistula in the arm. And so what that is, for those in the audience who don't know, is a special kind of vein that's designed in the operating room for patients who need dialysis. We do an operation on the arm on one of the veins and arteries that allows that vein to then grow bigger and stronger so that you could put 2 needles in there that would let a lot of blood flow out of the body into a machine that cleans that blood and then back to the person. So 2 ways you can do that dialysis at home. One is through that fistula with a special kind of machine that we can provide that the patient would use at home. And another is done through the belly called peritoneal dialysis. And in that type of dialysis, you never see a drop of blood.
Hmm.
There are clear bags of fluid that drain into the belly, hang out for a little while, a few hours, and then drain out. And believe it or not, that cleans your blood just as well.
Yeah, I heard that wasn't as good. That's what his current doctor said. He said, no, that's not as efficient, and you're more likely to get an infection.
So not as efficient is true, and I would tell you that that is also a benefit. And so what many people tell me when they get hemodialysis treatments is that, which are much more efficient, I feel like I'm washed out. After dialysis, I just feel like I need to go home and go to sleep and sleep for the rest of the day. With peritoneal dialysis, because it's less efficient, it's done every day, but it also doesn't give you that punch. So most people don't get that washed out feeling.
What? Thanks, Ann, for the call. Why do you get that feeling?
It's a lot. Can you imagine? Your kidneys are working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week without a break. And so in order to try to replicate that with the machine, we've got so much blood flowing out of your body and into a machine that's filtering that blood and coming back to you. We're essentially cleaning all of your blood during that time. It's very stressful on the body.
You had mentioned clear fluid saline solution, something? What is that?
It's very similar to a saline type solution if anyone's been in the hospital and see those bags hanging. So the beautiful thing about peritoneal dialysis is you don't even need electricity to do it.
Yeah.
If you had a bag of that fluid, it could hang on a pole. That bag connects to a tube that connects to a tube that we put into your belly. The fluid drains in. Then you remove it. You could go to the mall. You could go shopping. After a few hours, you drain that out. It can drain to just about anywhere, sink. And you would fill back up a little while later, and you would do that throughout the day.
But how does this filter the blood? I thought the idea was to get the blood out through something that cleans it and then back in.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So with hemodialysis, actual blood is coming out of your body and getting filtered.
Right.
In the peritoneal dialysis, we take advantage of your natural filtration. So there are tons of tiny little blood vessels all around the inside of your belly. And so if we take that space and expand it and put some fluid in there, things that are in very high concentration in the blood, toxins that your body made that you don't need, they flow from those little blood vessels across the wall and into that fluid. And then when you drain it out, they're gone. Mm.
Dr. Vincent Carcillo is our guest. Internal medicine and nephrology, the topic on Medical Monday. 1-800-348-2551, the number. Mary in Springfield. Mary.
Hi, I'm having cancer treatment, and so I use Tylenol on a daily basis, probably 30 to 50 worth total. So I'm not exceeding the amount, but I am having it frequently, and I mean years. Is that too much to have Tylenol long term?
Generally not, and we don't worry so much about Tylenol, at least not as much as we worry about the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, and the most common one over the counter is ibuprofen. Much more problems related to the non-steroidals.
Interesting.
Great. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're
welcome.
Thank
you, Mary. 800-348-2551, the number. Nathan in Clifton Park. Nathan.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Yes, I have a concern, mild concern. Just turned 50 recently, and sorry, I'm out of breath. I'm noticing when I drink a pint of water, it's passing through me very quickly, like 20, 30 minutes. And, you know, it used to not be like that. Is that a sign of something? Anything to be concerned about?
Well, so are you also noticing that you need to go frequently in the nighttime? Does it wake you up?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So, gentlemen, as we get older, in many cases, our prostate gland gets bigger. And so the prostate gland wraps around the tube that goes between your bladder and the outside world. And so as that gland grows, sometimes it can crimp the tube. Mm. And if it does that, you start to get those symptoms of more frequent urination and nighttime urination. So it's something that you want to get checked out by your primary care doc.
Oh, goodness. Okay.
Welcome to age 50, Nathan. Enjoy. Thanks. Thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551. Linda in Saratoga. Linda.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good. How are you?
Good, thank you. Listen, my son had a transplant in 2006, and he's completely med compliant, and he's pretty healthy. My question is his life expectancy the same as anybody's?
It's hard for a doctor to say that without viewing the patient, I would imagine.
I know, but I'm just saying, med compliant and healthy, would he have a normal life expectancy?
Well,
do you think, doctor?
Linda, God bless him. I'm glad that he got a transplant, and I'm so glad to hear that he's compliant with his medications. The transplant itself, it can be variable, right? So how long does the actual allograft last, which is the transplanted kidney, would definitely affect the person's, you know, life expectancy. If the allograft failed and the person, again, had end-stage kidney disease, that shortens the life expectancy quite a bit. But many transplants can last for decades now.
Hmm. Yeah, we've had it 15 years. It's from his father.
It's wonderful. It's such an excellent result.
Okay, so maybe a slight change, but the best course is continue as we're going with med compliance, right?
Absolutely. The transplant was the very best thing that he could do to treat his end-stage kidney disease.
Yes. I want to add one thing before I give others more time is when you're talking about hemodialysis, because we looked at that at one point, we had to be concerned about power outages in the Northeast, you know, at our house, power outages. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes, I do. And so power outages.
I just wanted to comment on that.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you did. And power and just living in the Northeast brings up some interesting points. Doing dialysis at home, you do have to be worried about power outages, again, except for peritoneal dialysis, which you don't need electricity to be able to do. But one of the things that people struggle with, especially this time of year, we've had a pretty mild winter so far, but we get ice storms and snowstorms, and the roads are bad. And so to try to get to an in-center dialysis treatment 3 times a week, you kind of throw the dice every time that comes up through the winter that they're not going to be bad roads.
Dr. Vincent Carcillo is our guest. It's Medical Monday. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you, 800-348-2551. Dr. Vincent Carcillo of Capital District Renal Physicians here to answer your questions today. And, Doctor, two emails and then back to the phones for the home stretch. This one's from Brian in Pittsfield. Brian writes, my son Quinn is 8. He was born with multicystic kidney of the left kidney. That kidney has since shriveled up and gone away and is not affecting his blood pressure. If he maintains a healthy lifestyle throughout his life, is his life expectancy any less than a healthy person with two functioning kidneys?
Well, that's a great question, and I hope and I think I'm glad to hear that your son is doing so well. But the answer is yes. If you have one healthy functioning kidney, you can live with and have a very, very normal life expectancy and a healthy life at that.
Now, you mentioned that there were some that you have seen that had three or four kidneys. Do you say, hey, listen, do you want to be a donor? You got a couple extra.
In those cases, those kidneys are not all necessarily kidneys that would be healthy enough to transplant into another person.
Gotcha.
And it's somewhat rare to see that as well.
What are some of the important criteria that you have to meet in order to donate a kidney to someone? Do you have blood type the same and things like that?
Sure. Blood type, in general, blood type does need to be the same. There are some instances where they can do some very creative things about blood type. But blood type, yes. One of the things that nephrologists will see potential donors for is just to make sure that they're a healthy person, that they don't have things that would affect their own kidney health, like high blood pressure, like diabetes, like having protein in their urine, which is a marker for damage, as we mentioned.
This one's from Robert. How can you tell if there's protein in your urine?
Well, the easiest way to know for sure is to have a simple urine test, that can be done at your primary care doctor's office. We do a lot of screenings throughout the area. The National Kidney Foundation does a lot of screenings where you can do a quick urine screen to see if you have protein. One of the things that some people do notice, and usually this is in cases where there's quite a bit of protein, you start to see foaminess to the urine as a kind of a new characteristic.
All right. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Julie in Charlton. Julie.
Yes, hi. I was diagnosed about 40 years ago with postural protein loss, and I've been on hormone replacement therapy for 30 years. I'm just not sure. Should I be worried about postural protein loss and what causes it, and do hormones have any effect?
So, Julie, thank you for that question. The postural protein loss is something that we usually see in young women and something that is generally very benign, if that is the diagnosis. And the idea of it being postural is when you're standing up, you tend to have more protein in your urine, and when you're laying down at night, for instance, you don't. So how do we catch that? Well, sometimes we'll do separate collection of urine first thing in the morning, that is just a sample of the nighttime urine, and then another sample from the daytime to help figure that out. But it's interesting when you say that you are on oral birth control, that oral contraception can sometimes cause protein in the urine. So not sure in your case exactly what workup you've had, but.
Okay. They did the morning testing, and am I supposed to do anything about it?
I'm sorry, I missed that. They did what?
They did the morning urine testing, and then I wasn't sure if I'm supposed to do anything about it.
You better call the
Yeah, I mean, I would follow up with it was a nephrologist, I take it, that did that test for you?
No, just a nurse practitioner.
Okay. Well, I would follow up, make sure that you understand what the results were and what they thought they needed to do from there. Again, hard for me to know specifically what your test result looked like.
All right, Julie, thanks a lot. What exactly is going wrong when somebody, a young lady, gets postural protein loss?
So postural protein loss is a little bit different, and some people just have a little bit of a leaky membrane where that filter is. And protein loss in general in the urine, we talked about that specific little filter that's in each kidney, and there's over a million tiny little filters in every kidney.
Right.
And if you were to kind of blow it up under a microscope and look at it, it kind of looks like a ball of rubber bands. And they're tiny little blood vessels all kind of squished together, and there's pressure in there that squeezes fluid out, and that's eventually what becomes your urine.
Right.
And so now we can think of it as being like a strainer of anything else, like a pasta strainer. Normally, salt and water is getting filtered through those blood vessels, and that's what makes up your urine. If there's damage to that strainer, well, you could get pasta in the sink. And it's the same idea. If there's damage to that little filter that we call a glomerulus, you can start to see proteins escaping through those through those cracks and getting into the urine. And in a case of postural proteinuria, it's benign. It doesn't cause kidney damage over time. But in many other cases, protein related to other diseases, it is telling that there could be damage.
Very interesting. Well, I like the way you used pasta in your description. You want to be on Food Friday?
No. Here you go.
Judy in Saratoga. Judy, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Quick question. Can you hear me okay?
Sure.
Okay. Many years this has been going on and not a doctor's found out why. If I drink red wine, I take one little sip just to taste it and my arms go numb.
Yikes. Don't do that then.
Yeah, they literally feel them just like hang with numbness.
What the heck?
From the shoulders down.
All right, figure that one out, Carcillo.
I wish I could, Judy. That's super bizarre. I've never heard someone complain of that before.
Think it's like a nitrite allergy or something?
It could be something like that. Do you get a rash when that happens as well?
No rash. And I've tried organic wines also and just red wines. And it's been on probably 20 years now.
So booze doesn't do it to you or beer?
Correct.
Weird. That's really weird.
Yeah, super weird.
Well, I'm sorry about that, Judy. Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Vincent Carcillo of Capital District Renal Physicians is here to answer your questions. John and Ware, you're on.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I was listening to one of the people that called in, and they had said that, you know, electricity being a problem. And I had that same concern, but it really wasn't a problem. I mean, the amount of times the electricity goes out, and it's probably been like three times this past year that I've had it go out, and all you do is emergency rinse back, and it's really easy.
What do you do?
And then you just continue this next day. My wife had a lot better care and ability to go and do dialysis when she wanted it. We did it four times a week, sometimes five. You could skip a day and go out to dinner at your, you know, whatever you want to do, as long as you make the session up. And if it's snowing outside, you still can do it. You know what I'm saying? A lot better, good benefits to having hemo.
What if your power goes out for a week, though?
Regular life.
What if your power goes out for a week, John? I mean, I've had that happen where we had an ice storm 10 years ago, and the power was out for a week. What happens, man?
Yeah, we have no choice. You have to use your generator, which I have.
All right.
A small little Honda generator. Well, actually, I don't have a Honda, but a generator.
Fair enough.
And you just... I had one. We were out of power, and I didn't have my generator, but I had one in my truck. I drove my truck by the side of the house, plugged it in.
Wow.
Started my truck up.
Oh, that's good.
This was an issue, though, in Puerto Rico when they lost power for so long.
Right.
There was a small island off the coast of Puerto Rico called Vieques where the dialysis unit there was destroyed. And those patients who were on hemo in center, they were having to travel by plane or by boat three times a week to the main island for dialysis. Interesting thing about peritoneal as a kind of a contrast to that, those patients generally don't need to move and get displaced when you do lose power for an extended period of time.
You know what concerns me about this concept, and I've never seen the machine for home dialysis, is keeping it clean. In other words, we've often heard horror stories from those who have CPAP, the old CPAP machines. They clean this thing out, but I still get a sinus infection every 2 weeks because There are little microbes in there. You have a dialysis machine. Your blood's going through it and then back in. How do you keep that thing up and sanitized?
Yeah, I wish I had one here, and if everyone could see it with us. The machines are actually very, very simple to set up. And the parts of the machine that have things kind of moving through them, it's all going through tubing, and that tubing is changed out each time. So you don't have to worry about cleaning anything that's getting recycled.
Gotcha.
None of that is getting recycled.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Vincent Carcillo is our guest. And Roslyn in Pittsfield, you're up. Hello. Roslyn? Are you there? I think Roslyn is not listening. Hello, Roslyn. Okay, goodbye, Roslyn. Sorry about that, Roslyn. And over to Jack. Jack in Scotia.
Hello there.
Hello.
Doctor, you just had a patient call in about having reactions from red wine, but not beer or, as Ray puts it, booze. But could that be due to the nitrates that are in red wine?
So we didn't really know what was happening with Judy, unfortunately. You know, there are people who have issues with nitrates in red wine, and many times they get headaches and that kind of thing from that. But
I knew one personally, and unfortunately she was Italian, and she couldn't have red wine with a pasta.
Oh,
yeah,
no.
That's bad. That's bad.
So it's not always a direct correlation there.
It's generally there's not a direct correlation between that and having kidney disease.
And I got to tell you, Jack, that call really stumped the doctor here. So this is a new one on us.
Right.
Thanks for the call, sir. We appreciate it. Over to John and Ware.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I don't know what happened. We got cut off.
Oh, okay.
I was talking about the hemodialysis I was doing for 6 years for my wife.
Oh, yeah, Joseph, thanks for that. And, you know, it was very, very nice of you to share with everyone that that the experience was so good, and the flexibility of your schedule made it such that you could live your life. And, you know, when I have patients that are starting dialysis and it's such a big life change, I often will say, don't do dialysis just to survive. Do dialysis to live your life. And it sounds like you guys did that.
All right, John, thank you for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. Michael in Albany. Michael.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hello. Doctor, just a quick question about when does a patient learn and how do you tell them that they need a kidney transplant?
Sure. And so for patients that have chronic kidney disease that we're following in the office, we do watch what we call filtration. Kidneys are working like filters in your body, and there are some blood and urine tests that we can check to see how well they're filtering. And then we have a staging system, 1 through 5, 1 being the least amount of damage, and 5 being the point where many people start to need dialysis. As people get into that blend of 4 to 5 is most often the time that people are looking at kidney transplant.
Okay, and just one follow-up to that, if I could. I don't know anything about a system for how you can get a kidney, but is there a long time wait to get one if you needed that to be done?
Yeah, it's very interesting. So patients that we refer, and, you know, we have a great transplant center here at Albany Med with Dr. Conti as the leader there. Patients will go, and there's usually a group meeting once a month where patients learn about the transplant process. Some people have someone who they know or don't know, or a family member that's willing to donate a kidney to them, and that can happen within 3 to 6 months. Some people who are waiting for, you know, kind of specific features of an organ, it can be 2 to 3 or more years.
What's the oldest person that you know who got a kidney transplant?
That I know of was in the mid-70s, I want to say, 76, yeah, something like that, yeah.
You know, given what a dialysis machine does, has there been any movement, any progress on an artificial kidney?
There has, particularly at the Geffen School of Medicine in California. they've been working on an artificial implantable device, and nanotechnology has been helpful in that. There are, you know, early studies, but nothing that's really clinical that makes that available sometime within the next couple of years. Nothing that we've seen so far.
Dr. Vincent Carcillo is our guest. 800-348-2551. Eileen in Springfield. Eileen. Hello.
Hi. Hi. Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. You spoke with someone earlier who was having an onset of frequent urination, and I had a friend in that age bracket who was male, and that frequent urination was the onset of diabetes. And I wondered if that's still the sign of adult onset diabetes also.
It's a great point, Eileen. You know, frequent urination doesn't have just one cause. And in women, there is no prostate gland, right? So, you know, diabetes, especially, you know, prior to its diagnosis, you can have very high blood sugars, a lot of sugar moving into the urine and very frequent urination. Those people are also usually very thirsty. But sometimes in women, too, frequent urination can be a sign of urinary tract infections. So there are different causes sometimes for urinary frequency. So thanks for bringing that up.
Eileen, thank you for the call. And now let's grab at least one or two more here before we get out. Nancy, who is on the road. Where are you on the road, Nancy?
I'm on 88.
Okay.
On my way to Albany.
Well, you are on the air. Go ahead.
I am on the air. Okay, great. Thank you. I had a father who had stage 3 kidney disease. And my uncle, his brother, also had the same thing, and he had to have dialysis. And my father was close, but then he passed for another reason. And my question is, in the heredity, is this something I should be concerned about? Because, like, recently I've had a kidney infection, kidney stones, and I don't know where this stuff is coming from. And would you think it would be smart to consult a nephrologist?
So anytime you're worried about maybe having a problem with your kidneys and maybe you've had a lot of kidney problems run through the family, a good first step would be to talk through it with your primary care doc. And they're kind of a good judge for who should or shouldn't be seeing a nephrologist. And they're usually the source for referral to our specialty. But, you know, more specifically, as far as looking at patients who, you know, have hereditary kidney disease, there are a lot of different diseases that have different patterns of inheritance. Some of them are very dominant and run through family lines. Some of them are much more sporadic. So, you know, not knowing exactly what's happened in your family, it's not a guarantee that you will have kidney problems.
All right, Nancy, thanks so much. Very quickly, we only have about 30 seconds. Jackie in the Berkshires. Jackie, go ahead.
Hi, I have stage 3 moderate due to cardiorenal syndrome, and I wonder what you think about stem cell therapy, if I have any hope of getting recovering at all.
So have you spoken with someone about stem cell? Have you been offered stem cell therapy?
Yeah, my nephrologist doesn't think that it's doable or it's not proven or it's not being used, but other alternative doctors are saying that it is effective, and I just wonder if you have read anything or have an opinion about it.
And you said you have stage 3 chronic kidney disease?
Yes.
So stage 3 chronic kidney disease is the biggest category of people, and sometimes stage 3 disease can be relatively mild and something that won't progress to end-stage kidney disease. So we'll take it case by case, but yeah.
All right, that's where we will have to leave it. Jackie, thanks for the call. Support comes from Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, helping fight the epidemic opiate crisis both locally and throughout the country with specialized programs, education, and support for men, women, and families. VillaVeritas.org for inquiries. Well, that's it for today. Sorry if we left you on the line. Thanks to Dr. Vincent Carcillo for joining us today. And thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Beautiful job. Phones answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, this is exciting. Gene Gagnon will be back to answer your travel questions. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.